Hi, welcome to this week's program.
As humans, almost all investors are naturally inclined to follow tendencies dictated by our psychology. We extrapolate recent events into the future, and we're scarred by prior traumas. You know, these reactions make total sense in some cases, but in the case of investing, they can ruin our future. That type of thinking can cause us to extrapolate rising markets as if they'll continue to rise forever, or extrapolate market declines as if they never end. And both of those can go hand in hand. Remember real estate in 2005? So many people extrapolated that this rising market would go on indefinitely. Or how about 2008? Yes, it was scary and the decline was downright brutal. But did the United States go out of business? Of course not. Yet so many pulled their money out of the market only to see it rise without them. So yes, we have gotten to expect that markets pretty much go straight up. And they've been doing that since March of 2009. But the minute that we see any deviation from those expectations, we anticipate a market meltdown like 2008. The reality is, though, that the future doesn't always follow such extreme examples. As a matter of fact, those extremes are really quite rare. And indeed, extreme is a word that can be used to describe both the disaster of the financial crisis in 2008 and the tremendous bull market that followed, both of which were almost without parallel. In reality, though, the market is more inclined to follow a pattern seen throughout much of its history, and it's one that has more volatility than we've seen in the past, and one that might neither go straight up nor straight down. We must recognize the trade-offs that dictate the fact that, with higher potential reward, comes the necessity to undertake more potential volatility. And this volatility often means losses from time to time, in a way that is neither extraordinary nor necessarily predictive of any looming calamity. And yes, there are positives and negatives in the world, but when is there not? Some of the positives today are the U.S. economy is growing strong enough to provide for pretty strong payroll numbers and gains in payrolls in the last quarter. And this is good for the economy because it means more people will be buying real estate. Real estate is a good driver for consumer spending, and it has very strong positive indications for the future. Now, the negatives, we hear about them very strongly right now. There's global growth concerns, such as in China, and that could have ripple effects through the global economy. The strong U.S. dollar continues to be a strong headwind for U.S. corporate profits. And the sharp plunge in energy prices has prompted a sharp cutback in capital spending by many energy firms, and this has had ripple effects throughout the stock and bond markets. You know, they say you always climb a wall of worry in Wall Street, and it really does you no good to fret about it. But I can instead offer a few questions for you to think about. Have you calculated or sat down with somebody who will help you measure the outcome of good and bad markets on your financial goals? I mean, in particular, within the context of how you want to live, not some generic one-size-fits-all calculator that you found on the internet. Can you or your advisor identify those areas of your finance that are in your control and those that are not in your control? Knowing this is the key to what to do if something out of the ordinary happens. And make sure this analysis includes understanding the psychology of investing to help you make the right decisions and to help you understand what money really means to you and how money's role in your life motivates you. In other words, does money represent the attainment of happiness for you or perhaps freedom from fear for you? Also, in times like these, it's imperative that you recognize the human instinct to do something. This instinct ignores the most basic principle that we may be merely returning to an era of normal volatility. And more volatility is indeed normal. According to research, as a matter of fact, stock market volatility over the last 13 weeks is at the low end of the range of what is considered normal and typical. In fact, over the long span of time, the market experiences a decline of at least 10% once every 72 trading days on average. Yet over for the past 35 years, the U.S. stock market has been up far more years than it's been down. So try to keep things in context. And doing nothing, by the way, is also an action. And sometimes it's the hardest action to take. Also remember that stock prices are daily quotations of the opinion of the value of very large businesses. These businesses' actual value or intrinsic value is often something quite different than what is quoted on a daily basis. However, over time, the share value will reflect the real value of the business. This is the way things work, and it's important to always keep this fact in the top of your mind when making investment decisions. So how are you doing right now? The market is picking up volatility, right? Some days there is fear in the market, and some days there is elation in the market. And what does Buffett say about fear and elation? He says, buy when others are fearful, and let me hear it, sell when others are greedy. So, which emotion is controlling you right now? You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. I always say there are two basic ways to get on your path to financial security. You've got to save and invest wisely. But of course, for many of us, saving is hard to do. Either you have to make more money or reduce your spending. You know, the way I say it is, either you raise the bridge or lower the water. However, there are some who spend in such a way that experts recognize it as compulsive behavior. Let's address this today with my next guest, April Lane Benson. April is a psychologist and expert in the study and treatment of compulsive buying disorder. She's also the author of To Buy or Not to Buy, Why We Overshop and How to Stop. Hey, April, welcome to the show.
Steve, thanks so much for having me.
So how does one know whether their shopping behavior actually is problematic?
There are a number of ways to know. The most succinct is if you are buying or shopping so much, or even thinking about buying or shopping so much, that it's negatively impacting your life in a serious way. We think, of course, financially as the way it impacts people the most. However, there are a number of other negative consequences.
What are they?
People have problems at work. They are often put on probation because they are going out for these long lunch hours because they get mesmerized by the stores, or they are buying online during the day. Mm-hmm. They have to work two or three jobs just to pay the minimum payments on credit card bills, pay for stuff they didn't need and use. There are interpersonal conflicts, fights with spouses, between parents and children. There are emotional consequences, anxiety, guilt, shame, and personal development consequences. Somebody is using so much of their time, energy, and or money shopping and buying that it's not available for other things like travel, cultivation of hobbies, talents, relationships with other people, with nature.
Sure, I understand. So I would think that a lot of people really aren't thinking about their state of life, and they may also be in denial because it feels good to do these kinds of behaviors. And it's not just the buying behavior, it would be any kind of compulsive behavior that you have to do, and yet it has its consequences. So what is the first step for someone to take in order to realize, hey, I may have a problem here?
I will definitely answer that. The one thing I'd like to say before that relates to what you've just said, Steve, and that is what's different about this is called the smiled upon addiction, because consumption fuels our economy.
Uh-huh.
So it makes it sometimes harder to really acknowledge and try to get help for.
Mm-hmm.
That said, acknowledgement is really the first step. There's so much denial around this and shame around this. So being able to look at it squarely and say, I have a problem with this, is an enormous step. From there, one has to know something about what it's all about. What is the function that this is serving in your life? Is this about exacting revenge from somebody? Is this about trying to be more in control? Is it about belonging to an appearance-obsessed society? Is it about avoiding something in your life? So you need to know something about what's the function, how it all began, what triggers it in the present, what the consequences are. You need to learn about your ambivalence, and you need to think about your vision for the future.
Mm-hmm.
How would you like to have lived your life at the end of it?
Mm.
And is the way you're living now going to get you there? And if not, what changes do you need to make? And finally, you need to understand what it is you're really shopping for. It's not that eighth pair of black boots.
Mm-hmm.
It could be love and affection, the need to belong, the need for self-esteem, the need for the esteem of other people. So teasing out what you're really shopping for and finding a way to get that is really the ticket.
My guest is April Lane Benson. She's a psychologist and an expert in the study and treatment of compulsive buying disorder. Her book is To Buy or Not to Buy, Why We Overshop and How to Stop. So in the purpose of lack of time that we have, let's get into some of specific ways that people can help themselves to get started. Let's start with credit cards, because that gives you excess buying power, a leverage up over and above what real dollars you may have. And you can also get trapped into this idea of paying minimum monthly expenses and so on. So briefly, what can a person do if they find themselves buying too much with their credit cards? Is that a way to start the healing?
It's definitely a way to start. Cutting up credit cards, not using credit cards. The pain of paying is so minimized with credit cards that if people can use cash and a debit card, that goes a long way. There are also a number of other kinds of resources. There are blogs that help people get support. We have a text messaging program where people get texts every day to try to motivate and inspire them.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about that in a minute.
Sure.
Yeah, so go ahead.
So avoiding credit cards is enormous, and it's not everything, because one can find other ways. I work with people who use other people's credit cards, borrow money. So I do think that avoiding the use of credit cards is an enormous first step. And I think empowering yourself by understanding Debtors Anonymous is a free resource that many people use. You know, I think you need support. It's important not to feel isolated and to know that you're not alone.
Mm-hmm. My guest is April Lane Benson, and she is the author of To Buy or Not to Buy, Why We Overshop and How to Stop. And to find out more about April and to hear this interview again, remember to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. April, let's talk about this personalized text messaging service that people can use to help them at, I think, these points of time when they may be inclined to overshop.
Yes. The program we've developed is an interactive one and a personalized one. What that means is that someone gets between 2 and 5 texts a day, depending on the time of year, whether it's holiday time and triggers are much more likely to be present. And one of their messages every day is tailored particularly to their overspending profile. They've filled out a survey, and that informs what texts we send them. In addition, they can text the system 24/7 to get immediate help. If they have an impulse, if they've started shopping in a bricks and mortar establishment, or if they've started shopping online, they immediately get a text back, some of which are linked to 1-minute audios that we've produced that help them take that all important pause.
How does someone find this text messaging service?
On my website, shopaholicnomore.com, you'll see it right on the homepage. There's a link to the page that we have that describes the program in more detail
mm-hmm.
and tells you how to order it.
Sounds really good. There's another article that you've written that really caught my attention. There is this population of people who buy after they've been drinking, and it's kind of an online version of DUI, but it's called BUI, buying under the influence. Tell us about that.
We have found that people who either go shopping, either at home online or in a store, who have been drinking, their inhibitions are much weaker. So the barrier to entry, to the shopping entry, is much weaker. We also know that there are many stores now, especially some of the smaller, select, boutique-type stores, that invite people in and have drinks and hors d'oeuvres with this express purpose, even if it isn't verbalized.
The impulse to buy, or that urge, quickly blurs into a must. You wrote here that suddenly the $850 David Yurman amethyst, an 18-carat gold ring, doesn't seem like a silly splurge. It's a reward.
Yes, and buying to reward oneself is something that people do a great deal of time. However, especially somebody who's got a problem with this, it's anything but a reward. It ends up feeling eventually like more a punishment than a reward, because eventually, you know, the piper has to be paid.
Of course. Now, you know, recently you wrote that the New York Post ran a story about a city pet store that had to ban drunken puppy buying. A quote here, customers tend to stumble in after happy hour and purchase a dog without thinking. The owner of La Petite Puppy said she now forbids the inebriated even to hold her puppies and instructs the more insistent to come back the next day.
And that is a responsible shopkeeper somebody who really cares about the puppies.
Yeah, that's very true. According to Joanna Douglas, writing in Shine, she said, number one, the way to stop this is don't drink near your favorite shops, don't day drink, avoid late night infomercials, and restrict your online use after drinking, and have a support system. And I guess, you know, getting this message system from April Lane Benson is probably not a bad idea at all. The final words, April?
I think that the words that you just used, I think all of those are very good advice. And my final words are, you can never get enough of what you don't really need. So finding out what it is you're really shopping for is very important.
My guest, April Lane Benson, psychologist, author of To Buy or Not to Buy, Why We Overshop and How to Stop. And to find out more and hear this interview again, join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. A recession is inevitable. We know that, especially now with tariffs, the trade war, and the possibility of a looming war in the Middle East. So, do you wonder how it will affect your financial security when it eventually comes? This is exactly what I'll be speaking to you about at my next workshop. I'll show you how to calculate whether you'll be financially secure for the rest of your life and how to make the right decisions to get financially secure and stay there. We'll talk about where to get the income you need, especially in this low interest rate world, and I'll also talk about how to get an early read on the next recession and ways to make sure your portfolio is properly positioned. These are just a few of the topics I'll be discussing, and of course, as always, I'm there to answer any of your questions. So, join me Tuesday, October 15th at 10 a.m. at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. That's Tuesday, October 15th at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. Go to stevepomerantz.com to sign up. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I'm happy to bring back my next guest. She is Elizabeth Granados. She is the creator and CEO of Little Nomad, beautifully illustrated printed play mats. And she was a guest on our show June of 2016, as she had just finished a very successful Kickstarter campaign and she was launching her business and it was showing some very promising results. Well, fast forward now, she has been recently on an episode of Shark Tank. So I've asked her back here to talk about that experience. Welcome back to the show, Elizabeth.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much.
So just to quickly review, you know, we talked about last time in the last interview, how you got started by contacting certain mommy groups online. Just give us a quick rundown of how you initially began.
Sure. So I had this idea for a product, a stylish foam baby playmat, and working with the designer, came up with a final concept, and then we created a photoshopped image. And I basically started just sharing that with Facebook mom groups that I was in, and people were adding me to new groups. So trying to gauge whether or not it was a product that resonated with moms, and it absolutely did. So in sharing that photo, I directed people who were interested in learning more to a landing page where they could sign up their email address. And in the background, I was preparing a Kickstarter campaign to launch the product and ultimately used those email addresses to announce the availability of the product and pre-sell over $100,000 worth of playmats.
So the Kickstarter campaign lasted how long?
It was a 30-day campaign.
What did you raise?
$104,000.
So what were your plans with that money? What was the next step?
So the next step was to manufacture the product. I hadn't even created the mold to create a final prototype, which is something actually that I regret. Looking back, I wish I had invested in creating the prototype prior to the Kickstarter so that I wouldn't have felt so time crunched. So ultimately, when you're manufacturing something, you start with a final sample prototype. And I used the funds to create that, manufacture a large quantity of inventory, import it, and to ultimately fulfill those initial orders and use the remaining funds to, you know, set up the business and get it rolling.
Right. Was that enough money for you?
Yep. It definitely got me off on the right foot. I didn't have to infuse any more of my own capital once I was rolling with the Kickstarter funds. And I continued to pre-sell online. So I was continuing to take orders even after the Kickstarter ended, which helped.
So you delivered your first product last November. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And where are you now? How much have you sold? And what's the growth trajectory of the business?
The growth has been great. As I mentioned, I continue to pre-sell, which I didn't put a lot of effort into between the Kickstarter and November. But once I started selling in real time, I have more than doubled the Kickstarter. So month over month, I'm seeing amazing increases. I've done almost now $250,000 or $60,000 in sales.
Congratulations. So you ended up on Shark Tank. How did that happen?
Well, I've always wanted to go on Shark Tank. It's something that I'm a huge fan of the show. So watching it, something I've always dreamt of. Literally, I've dreamt of being in the tank before. So being there was a dream come true and it was great for me. But there's a ton of applications. You can apply on their website on abc.com and creating audition videos for the executive producers. And just, you know, I think it was a little bit of luck and a ton of hard work is how I got on Shark Tank.
Before the taping, once you knew you were going to be on, as the days progressed towards the taping, what were you thinking? How were you feeling?
Well, you know, I was trying to just get as prepared as possible. So I tried to do everything that I could to prepare. I read all of the Shark's books and I just studied my notes and I learned as much as I could about my business so that I would be ready to answer any questions.
How about the presentation on the show? Obviously, you brought the mats and so on. You also had a special guest come with you, your 18-month, your 18-month-old baby girl. What was that like, having to give your pitch while the baby was there?
Well, I knew that it was a huge risk to bring my baby in with me, but how could I leave her behind? She was the reason that I did it, and she's my motivation every day. And she's just a huge part of the product. She's perfectly in the demographic for users. So I brought her out there. She was crying a little bit. I had to adjust and make sure that I had my pitch fully memorized so that I would be able to react if she was unhappy, which kind of happened, but it ended up being great.
The show aired February 3rd. I'd watched it and the baby was crying at one point and you did something unexpected. What was that?
Well, I swooped in and picked her up and then ultimately I asked Mr. Wonderful, we called him Uncle Wonderful, to just babysit for a moment while we continued with the pitch.
And that was risky, but he did okay. And there were some good
laughs.
Yeah, that was excellent. That was funny.
It was cute.
Yeah. So you were looking to raise a certain amount of money and you were willing to offer a certain percentage of your company for that. How did you determine the amount of the shares you were willing to give up and the amount that you needed?
Well, that was difficult, but I basically just looked at what I thought the value of my business. It was, I had such a short track record, and I knew that was a huge risk going into the tank with such a young business in it. And it proved to definitely be a disadvantage for me. But knowing what the sales were, knowing what the demand was, and knowing that I wanted to maintain ultimately control over my business, that's how I made my decision.
You got good reception, I thought, from the panelists. Mark Cuban was shaking his head up and down when you were telling him about Kickstarter and initial sales, and they very much liked the path that you were on. Were there any surprises and anything in particular that you learned from the experience?
Definitely. First, I have to say I respect the Sharks so much because they are able to really see entrepreneurs for who they really are so quickly. And watching the show back, even just seeing what they had to say about me in that moment, they were really spot on and they had some excellent advice. So now I'm staying focused on taking that advice and looking at how I could pivot in my strategy to improve my business based on what they said.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. What did they say? What did you learn?
Well, I would say, for example, with Robert's advice to double down on what's working for me.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much to learn about selling online, and I'm on the Shopify platform right now, and Shopify sends an email every day with e-commerce tips on how to improve your sales and to get your cart abandonment back and how to reach customers who are thinking about buying, but they've changed their mind, and using email sequences. There's so much that I still need to really implement in that respect. So I took that advice very much to heart to double down on what I know is working, and that's my online sales.
There was a lot of discussion about online versus bricks and mortar versus kind of traditional retail. There seemed to be some criticism from some quarters about pursuing the strategy of traditional retail. What did you think about that?
You know, I do think there's an easy argument both ways. As someone who just had a baby, I registered and everything was purchased through one store's registry. And so knowing that for this specific product, I do still feel that it is a great strategy. But that being said, with the online sales being great, continuing to focus on those and making the most of that. So as a small business still, that's what I'm focusing on rather than going straight to retail now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the online method has scalability.
Right.
Right. So when you're working even with registries, which is, I think, a great idea, you know, it takes an awful lot of work to get into a particular registry, an awful lot of work to service it and all of that. Whereas online, you know, it's really just a click and purchase.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all credit cards. So it's a lot easier and you can grow a lot faster. So is that, am I hearing that that's the direction that you're headed in now?
Yeah, absolutely. Another piece of advice that Robert gave is, you know, you don't know that much still. Because at the time, I hadn't shipped a single playmat. And now,
yeah,
several months later, and I have shipped and I've gotten some great customer feedback. And I feel as though I've learned from that. I'm going to continue to improve the product based on feedback. So I think phase two or three or four, or maybe never, you know, going to retail as Uncle Wonderful suggested, just staying away from it altogether, but definitely focusing on those things rather than jumping to retail immediately.
Well, Elizabeth Granados, I wish you the best of luck.
Thanks.
Tell us a little bit about the product and how people can find out about it.
Sure. It's available on our website, little-nomad.com. And you can also check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/littlenomadplaymat. It's a beautiful foam playmat. If you can imagine that, it looks like an heirloom rug, and it's for style-minded moms everywhere.
Well, once you get going, maybe you can go on Shark Tank 2, if the follow-up or something like that, and then maybe raise some real money. Best of luck to you, Elizabeth, and thank you so much for spending your time with us.
Sure. Thank you, Steve.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
I noticed some information on Florida Realtors' biggest legislative victories. Wow, that sounds really impressive, doesn't it? And one of the remedies was to open what has to do with open and expired permits. And when I said that, you practically jumped out of your seat.
That's a double yay.
So what's making you so mad about permits?
Okay, so here's the deal. The word open is a four-letter word. And as realtors, this kills us. First of all, to understand what this all means, when you go to sell your home, they run a tax lien, a city search, open permit search, and they undiscover these permits that have been sitting around since, I've got three of them this week from like 2004, 2005, 2008 different properties.
People open a permit, but they never close
it. So your air conditioner guy opens a permit, the hot water heater guy, the electric guy. See, there's all these permits that are laying around open that you don't know about. Now, here's the thing. You don't learn about this until like 2 weeks before closing when the title company runs their search. They don't want to run the search right in the beginning when you say you have a deal because A, it costs money. So there's a fee involved to just run the permits. So now you find out a week before closing, you have an open permit. This is a monumental task to get closed.
Yeah.
You have to, if the contractor still is in business, most of them are not,
that's a very good point.
So you're hunting down somebody from 2005, especially with roofs. We had a hurricane back in 2005, Wilma, and they almost like gave us carte blanche, just get your roof, whatever repairs you had to do. So there was like no permits going on.
Yeah.
Well, that wouldn't even really be a problem. The problem here is when somebody opened a permit but never closed it. So now the homeowner has to run to the city, reopen a permit that's expired because it's now an expired open permit, pay fees.
To catch it up.
Well, right. They'll charge open fee. I just had one done for $220. Then you have to get the city back out there to inspect it. Now, they're inspecting a roof from 2005. Do you think whatever was wrong 2005, they're even going to be able to pick up on? Yeah. It's almost like time for a new roof.
It's a joke, yeah.
So it really delays our closings. If somebody is insistent on it being closed out, I just had this today, as a matter of fact. The buyer insisted that it be closed out. They wouldn't close. Well, guess what? This was a three-way domino. If this first one didn't close, the second wasn't going to close, the third and the fourth one.
Yeah.
Over, I forget what it was, a silly permit. So the seller spent triple fees and then hired a closeout fast permit guy.
Specialist. There is such
There's
a thing?
Now, correct. They get paid a lot of money to deal with
this. Wow, I want to do that. Listen, anybody out there is looking for a job,
that
sounds like
a
great job.
It really is. Yeah. So this is really good news. I don't know exactly all the details. It takes effect October 1st, 2019. I mean, basically what it's saying is going to allow local governments to close a permit 6 years after its issuance, as long as there is no apparent safety hazard issues.
So they come out, they say you didn't repair a sinkhole and the ground is bowing again or something.
Right, right.
So no safety issues, obviously. So they'll just close it
out. But most of these are just silly open permits that are just hanging around.
Okay. So, you know, the thing is, I think there's some confusion. I know there was on my part about what you need to get permits for.
Oh, boy.
Because there's actually an article where this woman said, I wasn't able to close on my house because I didn't have a permit. I disclosed later that I had replaced the toilet. And I'm thinking, why do you need a permit to replace the toilet? It's inside the house. You were saying that faucets.
I mean, technically, almost everything in your house needs a permit. If you're going to go by the letter of the law. And so that brings up another subject that goes to seller's disclosures. So on the seller's disclosure, there's a question. Did you do any work without a permit? Or did any previous owners do any work without a permit? I would say, obviously, you can't be responsible for what other people did. So I would answer that as I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would even say I don't know as an owner almost, because you may not realize that that faucet that you changed out 10 years ago, oh, by the way, it's now you maybe changed the third faucet out with a permit, but not the first faucet out with a permit.
Oh, God.
I mean, where do you draw the line to this?
Well, first of all, it's insane that if I replace a faucet that I need to get a permit.
I'd get a plumber. I don't know. I'd want you to change it out, Steve.
Yeah, well, that's true. That is true. Actually, if I was changing it out, we definitely need a permit.
And a plumber.
And an inspection when I was done. No question. But that's the point. So if you replace your water heater,
right,
which is something you can buy in any big box or other store.
Right. I wouldn't install it yourself. You would need a plumber.
But the plumber has to go and create and open a permit.
Technically. Wow. Yeah. Which, of course, then you can go without hot water for a while waiting for your your permit to be issued.
Well, I think the big deal here is that a lot of people don't know what requires a permit.
Right.
You may answer on this form, is there anything outstanding? And you go, no, because you honestly think so. And then they find out later that actually
is an issue.
Is an issue.
Right.
And that could cause problems. And I think the big lesson here is that by the time they have to do a search for open permits, it's very, very late.
It's at the end. It's like a week, 10 days before closing. And that's where we were running into all these issues.
All right. I want to change topics here because there is some confusion as to what is a deposit that you're being asked to put down and what is a fee. So, you know, when you see the words non-refundable deposit, what is that? Let's talk that word through a little bit, those two words. So a deposit is something that you put down. Let's say you have a pet.
Right.
And the owner of the property wants to protect against any damage the pet does. So it asks you for a deposit. And then once you leave, if there is damage, then they can use money from the deposit.
Right.
Okay. That's one way a deposit is used. If the homeowner is saying to you, I'm going to charge you an amount to have a dog, that's a fee. But it's not a non-refundable deposit because that's an oxymoron.
It is an oxymoron. And it is hysterical because we talk in refundable deposit terms and non-refundable deposits. And a non-refundable deposit, no matter how you name it, is a fee.
Yeah.
But no, who wants to say, I'm going to charge you a fee for
that's
your pet?
Right, right.
Doesn't sound right.
So it's a use of words that actually obscures intent.
Correct.
And I'm not a lawyer, but I just sounded like one.
It sounded pretty good.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
The issue, the real issue, though, is you should not accept the terminology non-refundable deposit. You should say to the person, that's a fee, isn't
it? That's a fee.
Pet fee. Okay.
Pay the fee.
Well, we're out of time. I guess, as always, this is Terry Story, 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
A recession is inevitable. We know that, especially now with tariffs, the trade war, and the possibility of a looming war in the Middle East. So, do you wonder how it will affect your financial security when it eventually comes? This is exactly what I'll be speaking to you about at my next workshop. I'll show you how to calculate whether you'll be financially secure for the rest of your life and how to make the right decisions to get financially secure and stay there. We'll talk about where to get the income you need, especially in this low interest rate world, and I'll also talk about how to get an early read on the next recession and ways to make sure your portfolio is properly positioned. These are just a few of the topics I'll be discussing, and of course, as always, I'm there to answer any of your questions. So, join me Tuesday, October 15th at 10 a.m. at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. That's Tuesday, October 15th at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. Go to stevepomerantz.com to sign up. That's stevepomerantz.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Michael J. Palumbo is a trader, entrepreneur, and venture capitalist. He launched Third Millennium Trading at the Chicago Board of Options Exchange, and in less than 10 years, his $250,000 investment was worth in excess of $100 million. He then became the angel investor in a financial technology firm and exited when the startup was valued at over $1.7 billion. And he joins me right now to talk about his new book, Calculated Risk, The Modern Entrepreneur's Handbook. Michael Palumbo, welcome to the show.
Hello, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Mike, you know, this book is a handbook of sorts for entrepreneurs. It's a small book, but it's packed with lots of really good, easy to understand information. And, you know, one thing you do is you show us how to consider the viability of a new idea as well as the execution of that idea. I mean, it's one thing to have a great idea. It's another thing to figure out whether it's going to be successful and then, of course, execute it. You list kind of like checklists to start a new company. And the first thing that you mention in testing an idea is geography. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that's a great way to look at whether the idea is going to catch on well or not. And we call it the geography test. Geography test is basically just looking at how wide the likability of the product is going to be geographically. Are you going to appeal to people in one small area, or is it going to be more of a product that works with a lot of different people? Obviously, the bigger the better, because it'll be easier to catch on and it'll obviously be easier for growth. So that's one of the tests we use.
Yeah. So is it scalable? Can you take what you're doing right now and make it much bigger without, you know, having to spend tremendous amounts of capital in order to do that? What are some examples of companies that started out next to nothing and had this tremendous scalability?
Well, we talk about a few of them in the book, but I'll tell you, the best one that I can think of is Amazon. Amazon started out just selling books, basically, and now they've become the world's best retailer in terms of volume, in terms of sales. That's by far the greatest example of a company that started out small, but they realized that what they were doing is, as you say, scalable in a way where it can be just about any product, any retail product. Mm-hmm. And now you go on Amazon, you can buy anything.
Exactly, exactly. Another checklist item to look at is what you call feasibility. So when you say feasibility, what are you speaking about?
Yeah, that's a $5 word. Let me just make it simple here. I mean, we call it feasibility, but really, will it work given the current environment for technology? And even more so, when you have an idea, you're maybe trying to look a couple years out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, will the technology be there to be able to make this, we call it feasible, or make the product mm-hmm. be able to be sold? And we give some good examples there. Again, we go back to the dot-com era, and I talk about some of the companies like eToys, Pets.com. There were some companies that had what were good ideas on paper, but they were not executable. They were not able to be done based on the current, based on the current technology at the time. They were companies that depended on a very fast internet connection.
Yeah.
Things that we take for granted now, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
If they were launched a few years ago instead of, say, 1998, then it would basically have been probably a success. And a lot of the online retailers now that have the same ideas as those companies back then, they've done well.
Yeah.
But the problem is that at the time, those ideas were not feasible because there were not fast internet connections. It was slow. It was not as enjoyable.
A lot of it was dial-up back then, right? So it was
exactly.
Interminable. And then you didn't really, how could you, you know, paying online was an issue. It was hard to do.
Yeah. Right.
So you can have a great idea, but the timing or the technology might not be ready for your idea.
That's exactly what we go through in the book. And so the key here is that the idea could be great, but it also has to be timed right as well.
Yeah.
So both in terms of technology and also is the marketplace ready for that type of idea.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and it's funny because a lot of those companies that failed in the end of the 90s and early 2000s in the tech bust, those companies might have done fine right now because the technology is so much better.
Yeah, it's funny that we really haven't seen them. I mean, maybe they're out there, and I just don't know about them, but I don't know of an eToys or others like that.
Well, you know what? There are some. Let me real quick.
Sure, go ahead.
Gilt is a good one. That's a company that basically is all online. There are definitely some retailers that have been started just to work online,
mm-hmm.
but what's happened really is that the retailers, the big box retailers, have been forced to go online to compete with the Amazons.
And yeah.
So that's what actually happened is once the technology started to become available, the big box retailers went online,
mm-hmm.
even Best Buy and companies like that, because they had to. So instead of the eToys and the ones that just were online, you find most of the online things that are happening right now are basically companies that started off as brick and mortar
companies.
Yeah.
You know, maybe one reason is that they have this deep brick and mortar companies have been in business for so long. They have these deep benches of management. And one of the key terms or aspects that you look for is management competency. And I used a great example of VHS tapes, for those of us who are old enough to remember them, versus Betamax. Betamax was a competing tape manufacturer or platform, and it was actually superior to the VHS, but VHS won because of management incompetency on the part of Betamax. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they just didn't market the product correctly. And it just comes down to sometimes the best ideas don't win. And it's amazing that we use that as an example because it's such a great example of the fact that there was a better technology in Betamax, but because they didn't market it and get the word out to users and to companies that would be putting their products or their films out on that method, they were actually beat by an inferior technology. And people that look back on that really don't, maybe didn't pay that much attention, or there are younger people out there that didn't live through that era, they just hear of Betamax and just think that it must have been inferior, that it just, no, that what happened was his management was inferior.
Yeah.
And so just as important as the idea is, in fact, probably more important really, is that the founders have to know what they're doing. They have to be able to bring that product to market correctly. And that's an important aspect, probably more important than the idea itself. Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned that Sony made the Betamax, and what was it, JVC made the VHS? And JVC went right to the film producers and had more films put on the VHS tape. So the consumer got to recognize that more than the Betamax, even though the quality of the picture was better. So pretty smart stuff.
Exactly. That's basically shows that management has, you know, or founders, whatever, however you want to word it, but basically they're just as important to the success of a startup. And, you know, you can really make some bad mistakes in marketing your product and cost yourself the ability to gain market share, even with a superior product. So it's very important to make sure that you're a good salesman and not just a good inventor. And if you are not a good salesman, it's important to find someone as a partner that is, because we talk about this in the book as well, where when you start a company, you look at your own skill set, and it's important for you to evaluate what you're good at and what you're not good at. If you're not good at something, you need to find, especially sales, that's like the most important part of starting a company. You have to be a good salesman. If you don't have those skills, then you need to find someone that does.
You know, you're talking about sales skills. By the way, the book is Calculated Risk, the Modern Entrepreneur's Handbook. My guess is Michael Palumbo, a successful entrepreneur himself. We'll just talk about raising money. You know, raising money is really, really difficult. And you say even for great salespeople, raising money is very, very frustrating, time-consuming, and difficult. Why is that?
Because it's something that generally when you start a company, you've never had to do anything like that before in your life. So raising money, you have to be able to sell your idea to very sophisticated investors. And first of all, most entrepreneurs don't really have a skill set that makes them good at this. You know, a lot of people that think of great ideas, a lot of great idea people, as I said, are not great salesmen. So this is just a difficult thing to do for most entrepreneurs. And we talk about some of the things that VCs look for in a company, but I'll tell you what, as a VC myself, what I look for, number one, is the quality of the management or the quality of the founders. I think that's more important than the idea. And because I look at a Steve Jobs, you know, some of the great entrepreneurs in history, Henry Ford and Bill Gates, these guys, they could sell ice to Eskimos. I mean, I'll tell you what, you find the right people, and as long as the idea is a reasonably good idea and can pass the basic tests that I talk about as far as feasibility, et cetera, then you really look at the people and can they execute.
Well, one of the characteristics that you mentioned in your book is that for a company looking to find money or to raise money for their business, they should choose their investors. And there's, you gave a list of items that they should be looking for in the investor that they're going to basically be partnering with. One, as you mentioned, was good people. One was fair terms and pricing. And I want to talk about this for a minute because so many entrepreneurs, you know, you watch Shark Tank, people don't really know how to value their own business. There's always that tension between the panel and the presenter as to what they think the business is worth. And you really do give a good tutorial in your book about valuing your business properly. Give us some ideas based upon your own business, how you, at one time you had a need for money and you were offered $1 million for a large percentage of your company. I guess you turned it down because you did the math. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a great example. And you know, you bring up Shark Tank. I love that show because it really does show would-be entrepreneurs what it's like to go in front of VCs. And it's a great example of the fact that VCs generally know how to value a business better than the entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a guy like Mark Cuban, and these guys are sophisticated investors. They understand what these people's companies are worth better than the people that started the companies.
Yeah.
And it's just because the entrepreneurs, they're idea people, and they have these ideas, and they have these goals, and they have these great possibilities, but they don't really understand what it's worth. So a lot of times, as you said, there's a big gap between what the entrepreneur thinks the company's worth and what a VC who's more sophisticated would value it at. So in my own life, what happened was it was an early time in my company's existence. It was the only time that I was thinking about taking in some outside capital. So I went to you could call him a VC back then, an investor that was interested, and he was offering me $1 million to help the company grow faster for half the company.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, and I was more of a sophisticated investor than most entrepreneurs because I'm in the trading industry, so I kind of understood it a little bit better than some people. And so I turned it down because what he was asking for was basically to value my company at $2 million. I mean, if he's going to pay $1 million for half the company,
right,
that means the whole company is worth $2 million. And to me, even though we were young, we had huge growth potential, and I thought the company was worth much more than that. Now, you do find entrepreneurs that have a pie-in-the-sky valuation, a valuation of their company that's not reasonable. But in this case, I was very confident that this person was underpaying for what he was getting, and so I turned it down.
Well, you were able to try to make some growth projections of your revenues and your earnings and then discount them back to present value using, you know, the discounted cash flow model. And you were able to see that at least in this one valuation that your company was worth $9 million.
Right.
And so $1 million, maybe you could have offered him 1/9 of the company or maybe 20% of the company or something.
Exactly. So based on, and we talk about this in the book, there's a great method to value companies called discounted cash flow. It is something that I think entrepreneurs should at least have a grasp of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I put it in the book. It's a lot of numbers. It's a lot of math. But, you know, it's a chapter in the book that's important because if you understand that, then you can speak the same language as these VCs do.
Right.
Because the VCs all understand discounted cash flow. They
yeah.
all understand this, that type of thing. And entrepreneurs generally don't. So I was able to, yes, use discounted cash flow methods to project my earnings into the future and say, you know what, this guy wants 50% of the company and is willing to pay a number that's probably only about, as you said, about 1/9 of the company. So
mm-hmm.
because he would have been coming in and helping us grow faster, I probably would have sold for 15 to 20% of the company just because he would have helped me grow faster. And that does
yes.
help your valuation. I mean, we go through that in the book as well. But the bottom line was he was nowhere near the value that I thought the company was worth. And again, using discounted cash flow, you can kind of figure that out, at least a good estimate. It gives you a ballpark because you're always still based on what your projections
yeah.
are. And your projections should be off.
That's true. Absolutely.
Yeah, but I just knew that based on that, he was so far off that even if yeah. my projections were a little bit off, he was still nowhere near what it should have been.
Well, the key is you got to know your number. And it's the old saying that if you're sitting at a table playing poker and you're wondering who the patsy is, you're the patsy because they know the number. They should know your number. You should know your number. If you don't know your number, you're going to lose that game. And that's, you know, life's worth of work that you're not going to really want to lose. Hey, unfortunately, we are out of time. My guest, Michael Palumbo, the book Calculated Risk, The Modern Entrepreneur's Handbook.
The website's just called calculatedriskbook.com. It's all one word, and they can get the book there. And then they can follow me on Twitter at MikePal10. It's MikePal10. I just talk a lot about entrepreneurship. Wonderful. And a lot about the stock market.
Great. To find out more about Michael and to hear this conversation and interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. That's P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, stevepomerantz.com. Thank you so much for joining me, Mike.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure, Steve.
A recession is inevitable. We know that, especially now with tariffs, the trade war, and the possibility of a looming war in the Middle East. So do you wonder how it will affect your financial security when it eventually comes? This is exactly what I'll be speaking to you about at my next workshop. I'll show you how to calculate whether you'll be financially secure for the rest of your life and how to make the right decisions to get financially secure and stay there. We'll talk about where to get the income you need, especially in this low interest rate world, and I'll also talk about how to get an early read on the next recession and ways to make sure your portfolio is properly positioned. These are just a few of the topics I'll be discussing, and of course, as always, I'm there to answer any of your questions. So, join me Tuesday, October 15th at 10 a.m. at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. That's Tuesday, October 15th at the Boca Raton Renaissance Hotel. Go to stevepomerantz.com to sign up. That's stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by The Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which The Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.